Yes, at this time would be glorifying to you as we take a look at Joshua and the events of Jericho and your majesty on display there. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so we're continuing in our study of Joshua, and now we've finally got to the point of Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Anyone familiar with that song? And can anyone tell me why they say fit and not fought? Because... Oh, that might be. So as we get to the Battle of Jericho, I left off not quite finishing chapter 5 because it seemed to me that this went more with Jericho than it did with the events of chapter 5. So we get this new scene. Now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, "No, rather I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, "What has my Lord to say to his servant?" The captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, "Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you stand are standing is holy ground." And Joshua did so. All right. So this incident here, now Joshua, he's taking a look at Jericho, and he sees somebody there, and it's a little bit mysterious, because Joshua doesn't seem to immediately know the nature of who he's talking to, but this imagery here of a man standing here with a sword in his hand, it's actually only found in two other scenes in Scripture. All right, we find it in Numbers 22 and 23, chapter 22, verses 23 and 31. I'll read those to you in a sec, but can anyone remember for me what might be going on in Numbers 22? No, you're thinking Judges. Judges, that's Ehud.
The donkey talked.
Yes. Yes, this is Balaam. All right. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, the donkey turned off from the way and went into the field, but Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back to the way. In verse 31, then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed all the way to the ground. So that's one other incident where we have a person like this standing with their sword drawn. The second one is found in 1 Chronicles 21, 16. Then David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven with his sword drawn in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders, covered with sackcloth, fell on their faces. Anyone know what was going on there? That's when David did the thing which he shouldn't have done, and he did a census of the people of Israel. And then we have this event where he sees this person. I keep saying person, and we're going to bring that up in a minute, who and what the nature of that person is. But this person standing with the sword drawn, both with Balaam and with David, the result is fear. So here we have Joshua, and he doesn't seem to recognize initially who this person is or the nature of this person that's standing before him. And he goes over and asks him, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" That's kind of an odd question. Standing there with sword drawn, "Are you for us or against us?" And this man doesn't answer him. He doesn't say you, them. He says something entirely different. He says, "Indeed, I come now as the captain of the host of the Lord." And he says, "What is my Lord to say to his servant? Remove the sandals of your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." Does that sound like anything we're familiar with? What's that sound like? The burning bush. Right. And that is intentional. And it's important. Why might that be important? What's that?
It's another Christophany.
We'll get to that in a moment.
What's that link for Joshua from Moses?
Yes.
Moses' way he's treated
Joshua. Yes, this is another parallel between Moses and Joshua. All right, and we've already seen God say, I will be with you like I was with Moses. Right, so Moses had an incident like this where he was standing on holy ground talking to someone. Joshua now has an instance where he's standing on holy ground, which, by the way, not sure what having your shoes on or off, the difference that has to do with holy ground. I'm sure somebody more intelligent than I am has figured it out, but I don't get it. But this is just like the burning bush. So then we need to step back and look at this question, who is this that Moses is talking to? It's another one of those issues that theologians cannot agree on. There's about three different ideas. Two of them are more mainstream. One of them is that this is a pre-incarnate Christ. What's the word? I can't remember the word for it.
Christophany.
Theophany. I was thinking theophany, but Christophany. So we have Joshua standing before the Son of God. All right, the other main view is that this is an angel. All right. So, which way to go? Which way to go? Can someone look up Acts chapter 7, verse 30 for me? And I think Acts is relevant here, even though it kind of happens a lot later. We look to the New Testament to help explain the Old Testament, help us understand. And Acts 7:30 has a lot of bearing on this. Do you have it, Mark?
And after 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flame of a burning bush.
Okay, so in Acts, we're told that Moses in the burning bush is an angel. All right. Of course, now the Greek word for angel, it functions a lot like the Hebrew word. It can be either angel or it can be messenger. All right, so it kind of clears it up, but not entirely. But we have the burning bush is parallel to this. We have some strong similarities between Balaam and David and this. So if we call this a Christophany, we need to probably call the burning bush a Christophany and what happens with David and Balaam. Or, you see how those are kind of linked together. I'm inclined to say angel. Not going to step on it too solidly, but I'm inclined to think that way. More because of the connection between what David saw, what Balaam saw, and here. But I don't know. Typically, when we look at the New Testament, Jesus is not shy about saying, "That's me." You know, looking back to the Old Testament, he's got no problem saying, pointing to different things and saying, that's me. But he doesn't point to the burning bush and say, that's me. As a matter of fact, Acts says, angel. Is an angel, is a Christ? I don't know. But here we have it. Whatever the burning bush is probably the same thing here. All right, one way or the other. But this, I'm going to call it angel, but this angel, he identifies himself as the commander of the Lord's armies. So which armies is he talking about? What are our options?
The angelic host.
Or Israel. And both could be potentially valid here because Israel is this big army that's going in to take over the land of Canaan. Or we've got the angelic hosts who don't show up here. I mean, this is the one mention of angels or angelic kind of things, and in silence. So again, people go back and forth on it. I'm inclined to think, again, this is talking about the heavenly host and not the human host for a couple reasons. One, because everything about these passages is built around building up Joshua, right? And exalting Joshua. And this individual, whether it's pre-incarnate Christ or just an angel, either way, this being doesn't take over for Joshua. I mean, that it's kind of the end of the comment here. But he doesn't take over. And I'm going to leave you with that for a moment. We'll get back to this in a couple minutes. Because I do think that this is not a strange, irrelevant vignette that's just been tossed in. I think there's an actual clear purpose for this. We get to chapter 6 then. Now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. You shall march around the city. All the men of war are circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also 7 priests shall carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn and you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up, every man straight ahead." So we're pretty familiar with this story. God says, "I'm going to give it to you." And this is assurance they're going to win. This is a promise. And then he tells them to go walk in circles. Is that normally how we would take a city? My thoughts of storming a city, and I think from more 21st century military perspective, but I kind of think in terms of knocking on the door really hard with rams and scaling the walls or sieges. And they don't do any of that. Of course, the people are in this self-imposed siege. Right? They've already closed the doors. Nobody comes in, nobody goes out. They've bunkered down. And the men of Israel just pretty much ignore that. They don't even try to keep them penned up in the city. Right? They go out in the morning, they walk around, they go home.
In silence.
In silence. Well, it's not quite silence, though. You get that many people marching, and you can hear kind of this rumble. Right? But still, they're not saying anything. They just walk around and go home. And they do that for a week.
Except for the last day.
Except for the last day. Right. And God is going to do the heavy lifting here. Right. This is not "you shall take the city." It's "I'm going to give it to you." Right. So they walk around it seven days. First 6 days, once a day, seventh day, 7 times. Do you catch the number of 7 kind of rolling in there a lot? I think, it's been shown 7 has its own significance in Scripture. I think, and I can't find anyone else to talk about this, but I think Israel showed up on Sunday and started doing this on Sunday. It doesn't say what day of the week, but it does say on the 7th day, and that phrase 7th day has other significance. It's commonly associated with the Sabbath. Right. And what is the Sabbath? It's the day of rest. It's the day that God rested after making everything in the 6 days. It's the day that they've been told, hey, this is the day that you don't go out and gather for food or anything. This is the day of rest. And when it comes to taking a city, how much effort do they put into taking the city? They don't. I mean, you got the little bit when they rush in and wipe everyone out. But that's not really the work of a battle. All right, that's a cleanup crew. All right, they rest in God's work. My take, for what it's worth. So we get to verses 6 to 11. So Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let the seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, go forward and march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord. And it was so. Now when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went before and blew the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark, while they continued to blow the trumpets. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until the day that I tell you shout. Then you shall shout. So he had the Ark of the Lord taken around the city, encircling it once, and then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. So we've seen the repetition of seven. What's the other thing that's kind of hammered on here in this next verse is they follow their instructions.
Keep your mouth shut.
But we see that the Ark, right, it's referenced three times here in just a couple verses. Right, it keeps coming back to the Ark, the Ark, the Ark. Right, so this is more about carrying the Ark around the city. The Ark is what? The seat of God. What else? It has two names, three names. Anyone know what our three names are for the Ark?
Ark of the Covenant. I was like, I know the mercy seat, but it's part of the covenant.
Okay, no, the Ark of the Covenant, got the Ark of the Lord, and the Ark of Testimony. So, Ark of the Covenant, because it's a reminder of God's covenant with the people of Israel. We've got the second set of the Ten Commandments in there. All right, what else is in the Ark?
The rod that budded.
Manna. Why are those two things? The first one kind of helps us with the Ark of the Covenant name. What are the other two things demonstrate?
Manna was God's providence.
God's providence for how long? 40-ish years. Right. What's the rod that budded?
The priesthood.
Well, it has links with the priesthood and
the results is water, fresh water.
Fresh water, which was a miracle. Okay, so we've got God's power and God's faithfulness remembered. It brought together and kept in this Ark of the Testimony, which is, it's a reminder, it's a witness of the things that God has done for Israel and who He is to them. All right, so we've got the Ark, right, and this is all about carrying the Ark around the city these 7 days. Now Joshua rose up early in the morning, and the priest took up the Ark of the Lord. Oh, there we go, fourth time. Seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came after the Ark of the Lord while they continued to blow the trumpets. Did I just read that already? No. Thus the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp, and they did so for 6 days. So the people obeyed the instructions they get from Joshua. And this is faith. They're not just being obedient, but they're taking on faith that God is going to do something. So here, when something does happen, who gets the glory?
God.
This is God. Right? There's the people don't really contribute. Right? This is God's work, God's glory, and the people simply have faith. All right, it's faith in action. Ron?
Just looking at that this morning, just now dawned on me that this angel actually gave them instructions that was contrary to their normal way of behavior, because on the seventh day, they're supposed to take action, and actually the city collapses, and normally that seventh day is the day of rest.
Mm-hmm.
So their faith is actually really being tested to see whether they're going to believe and follow this angel, or whether they're going to go back and follow the tradition that they've had.
They aren't really following the angel, because he's kind of come and gone.
Well, yeah, but his instructions.
But his
they're following God's instructions today.
Yes, they are.
That's kind of unusual. That would be like you and I saying, well, an angel came down and told me to go to church on Saturday. He's changing.
The whole Sabbath Sunday thing is an interesting discussion. So we get to verse 15 to 19. Then on the seventh day, they arose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. Only on that day they marched around the city seven times. At the seventh time, when the priest blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So here we get this human acknowledgement, this shout, right, that God's given them the victory. Right. And here we look at this and we look at all these sevens and the walking and the horns. Right. And this kind of seems like ceremony, doesn't it? I mean, it's certainly not military, right, other than the marching, but it seems a little bit more like a ceremony. But we get to verse 17, and Joshua says, the city shall be under the ban, it and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Now, we've got something interesting going on here. Joshua says, this city belongs to God. Why might that be?
First fruits.
This is the first fruits. They've come into the land. This is the first city that they reach, and God says, "This one's mine." Right? It's a form of an offering, right? And I'm not going to get into the Hebrew here, but when we start talking about the language that goes here, the word for destruction is just one vowel off from the word. There's a word that's used for sacrifice. And it goes back and forth between this destruction sacrifice. Right? Jericho belongs to God, and it is the first fruits offered to God, right? Much like the first fruits of harvest, the firstborn of the animals that belong to the Lord. Right? This is first fruits. So this belongs to God, and that starts give significance then to the command, don't take anything. Right? Don't do it. So, because this belongs to God. This is His. So, go in, burn the city. Take it down. All right. But then we have this exemption. What's the exemption?
Rahab.
And everyone that's in her house. Right. What does that sound a little bit like? Does it sound a little bit like Lot? A little bit, because you got Lot, the one righteous person in Sodom and Gomorrah that was wiped out. Right? But there was this delivery of Lot. So we have Rahab here. All right, and
I was thinking the angel of death.
So we have this woman and her family. And the reason it makes me think of Lot is because you've got his wife and his daughters. Who else was kind of in his family that didn't get saved?
In-laws.
His in-laws. His two daughters were betrothed. They had been formally given to these men. That betrothal period hadn't been complete yet. And those two guys didn't believe. They laughed and said, what are you talking about? And they died. So I think about Rahab and these people in her house. These are people that listened to Rahab when she said, you really want to come hang out with me for the next week. You want to come live with me if you want to survive. So there's implication there that there's some measure of faith with the rest of it. But the focus is on Rahab. All right. So we've already listened to Rahab. We know how she was in this position because she'd spared the two spies. All right. So this is returning back to that story, and she's spared by command. Wipe everything else, but leave Rahab. And that begins, all right, even as we're closing the story of Rahab, that begins in this comparison. Because Rahab's, she's what? She's a Gentile. Right? And she is a Gentile, with at least by language, with a bad reputation. Right? And she is going to be brought into the household of Israel. Even though she's a Gentile, she becomes Israel. And we know that she becomes line of Christ. She's honored in Matthew as being an ancestor of Jesus Christ. So here we have this Gentile that becomes a Jew. And we're going to see, and this is going to be, I'm stealing a little bit of Mark's thunder for next week. We're going to see a Jew who becomes a Gentile. Right? And so there's this intentional juxtaposition as these two people change places. Now, what else do we see with Rahab? There's one other major principle that we find with Rahab. I'll let you think about that while we get back to her. So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. All right, so the walls fall. Remember I told you I was going to get back to who that angel was? Or whether angel or Christ, whether he was the commander of the earthly armies or the commander of the heavenly armies? What did the earthly armies do? Nada. All right, they walked around carrying the Ark of the Covenant, blowing on trumpets and not saying a word. All right. When the walls fall, this is God at work. I think that commander of the hosts, that was his job. He took care of the walls. So this is God's host and a couple of commanders that are parlaying as they come together, and the angel takes care of the walls, and or the Christophany, Jesus Christ, pre-incarnate Christ, either way you want to see it, handles the walls and then clears the way for Joshua to do the rest. So I think that's the role. Yes, sir.
Building a ramp so that the invaders could come over the ramp and get into the city. I've been involved in reading some of that. It was very interesting to see how they tried to do away with the heavenly, God-driven way of the walls coming down.
I have not. I've heard it. It's been a while. We talked about that when I was in Israel. Or the guy that led us around talked a bit about this. But no, I listen and I nod and say, okay, whatever. And I go back to what the Bible says. And
it's another case of man trying to explain away a heavenly event.
So the people wipe out the city then. Right? And we start getting to this why. Because, of course, from our modern perspective and our societal views, we start cringing and saying, ooh, really? Why? Why did they do that? And there is an answer, and you won't find it in Joshua. Anyone know where to find it?
There were other examples when they were told to do that, to wipe out all the living population. They didn't. They took all the young women and into their camp, made them wives, and the wives corrupted their religion.
Okay, there you got to it. All right. We see this, it's in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16 to 18. Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. You shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their God, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. This is about protecting Israel, not from some sort of physical contamination, but protecting them from spiritual contamination. And the interesting thing about Deuteronomy is that this punishment is specifically for the people of the land of Canaan. In that very context, God says, yeah, the people of the lands far away, if you conquer their armies, leave the women and children, let them live, take them as slaves. You don't have to wipe them out. But the people of this land that's nearby that I'm giving you, they need to go. So there is a distinction. There is something about these people that doesn't apply to the rest of the Gentile world that the Jews may or may not fight against. These people need to go. And we go back to the message, the passage Abby talked about last week. The sin of the Amorite is not complete yet. Right. They have become so corrupt, so wholly foul, that they can't be allowed to continue in any way. And if they are allowed to continue, are allowed to survive, Israel's going to go the same path that we've seen them go in the past when they interacted with the Midianites. There will be problems. So this is a very specific, a limited focus command that is specifically about the land of Canaan. Let me get to verses 22 to 25. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her." So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. And they also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's house and all that she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. So here we have, we get back to Rahab, and there's this really satisfying reciprocity that she saves these two guys' lives, and they come back and they save her life. All right, so there's that nice back and forth there. All right. But we get back to that interesting point with Rahab. What did Rahab do? What'd she do? No, I'm talking with respect to Israel. What'd she do? What'd she do before that? She believed. What else? She worked for their benefit. She saved a couple Jews' lives. She sent them back to finish their reconnaissance. So what, in the larger category, would you say that she blessed Israel? I would think so. Because she's now looking favorably towards the Jews, towards their God, their people, and acting for their benefit. And so we get back to that principle that goes all the way back to Abraham. I will bless those that bless you. And that's what's going on with Rahab. She has, in her own small way, to the extent that she was capable, she has blessed the Jews. She doesn't curse them, she blesses them. And so she is blessed. And that blessing is not only is she spared, but her family is spared. And not only her family, she gets to keep all her stuff. Everyone else, it's all burned or taken into the tabernacle, the treasury. Everything else burned, but her stuff, she gets to keep it. All of it. Anything that's in the house, she gets to take with her. So when we look at the destruction of Jericho, the whole contamination thing has more to do with the symbolism and whatnot than it does with any sort of contamination. She gets to keep her stuff. And she doesn't pollute Israel by bringing all her stuff with her. So we see the bless those that bless you, curse those that curse you principle in Rahab. But there's another principle here then. All right, we get the bless those that bless you, that's one. But then we get this blessing by association. All right. Rahab's father didn't spare those two men. Her brothers didn't have anything to do with it, as far as we're told. It was Rahab. So you would expect then that really Rahab's the one that should be saved, and the rest of them, well, you know, it sucks to be them. But that's not what happens, because they're with her. And to bless her means that these other people get blessed as part and parcel with her blessing. God blesses Rahab, and it spills over to the people in her periphery. So in the days of Jericho, it was a good thing to be in the periphery of Rahab, despite what the other people might think. The other thing we see that with this Gentile woman, God was willing to deliver Gentiles. And she has faith. She turns to the Lord. She fears the Lord. So there's a lot that's bound up in this story of Rahab and her deliverance. And then we get to the end of chapter 6. And Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds the city of Jericho. The loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his second, or of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. So the land of Jericho, that it was supposed to remain empty, right? And there's this curse that goes with it. Did it stay that way? Someone built it. As a matter of fact, there's a Jericho today. So someone built it. You know the rest of the story, Abby?
The curse was fulfilled.
All right, we see it in 1 Kings 16:34. In his day, Hiel the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid its foundation with the loss of Abiram, his first son, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub. according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. I don't know if this guy was unaware of the curse, didn't believe it would happen. You'd think if he was aware of it and he laid the foundation, he'd stop there. But it was cursed, and the curse was carried out. So then that curse that was carried out, there's the time of Elijah, so there's some time in between. Right? And it closes, so the Lord was with Joshua. Right? That's what God promised. He said, I'm going to be with you just like I was with Moses. The Lord was with Joshua. Right? So much so that the Canaanites knew who Joshua was. It wasn't just the Israelites that knew him, but you know, all the people he was about to go step on. They knew who he was. The complete defeat of Jericho with no loss. Nobody on Israel's side dies. That's part of God exalting Joshua. With Rahab, we see God's faithfulness, not only to his own people, but to Gentiles who are willing to believe, to those Gentiles who bless his people. We see with the deliverance of Abraham, and our deliverance of Rahab, we see God's faithfulness to Abraham. Right? Because remember, God made that promise to Abraham, and he continues to act on that 400 or 500 years later with Rahab. Right? We see God's faithfulness, Abraham, Joshua, the Israelites, right? To Rahab here, this believing Gentile, this helps us understand who God is. Right? To understand he is someone that keeps his promises. What he says, he does. Right? Of course, you don't want to be on the wrong end of that, like Hiel the Bethelite, right? Because what God says, he does. Right? And so as we look at Joshua, as we look at Rahab, this becomes a matter for us of trust. Trust, it's a fundamental foundation of any relationship. Right? No, yes, Mark.
What I like about Joshua, too, is he didn't make that promise to Rahab. He was one of his men. He had told the men, you shouldn't have said that. Sorry, but we're not doing it that way. But Joshua honored the commitment those men made to Rahab, which I thought it reflects well on his leadership.
It does. It does. So with relationships, there is not a single relationship that can progress beyond the level of trust that you have. Right? With marriages, if you don't trust your spouse, that's a huge limitation on that marriage. Right? With people that you work with, if you don't trust them, that becomes this massive limiting factor to the amount of interaction that you have and the kind of interaction you have. Trust is a foundation for relationships. And so our relationship with God is also built on trust. And we can look at Joshua, Rahab, Abraham. We look at this and we see that God is trustworthy. We need stories like this, showing God's faithfulness, his trustworthiness, so that we can look and understand, see who he is, and that becomes the basis then for the extent to which we trust God. So let's go ahead and close in prayer.